This is Performance Now, and I'm Carol here with my co-host, John.
Hi.
And we're super excited today because we have two amazing guests, Brian Getnick and Lihia Lewis. Brian is like one of the most amazing people in LA as far as supporting performance.
Absolutely.
And making spaces where performance can flourish and be in the midst of a dialogue. And we've been wanting to have him on the show for quite a while, so this is way awesome. And Lihia, Brian was in a project of Lihia's recently called Sorrow Swag. And I didn't see it, but John did. So we're gonna-
It looked amazing.
So we're gonna start by talking about that. But first, maybe both of you can do little intros for yourself, your backgrounds and your practices.
Oh, and I should also say that the third collaborator for Sorrow Swag, who isn't here, is George Lewis, aka Twin Shadow, whose public school mix we heard as the intro to the show today. So yeah.
Oh, nice. Thanks for the shout out.
Well, hi. I'm Brian Getnick. It's great to be here. Carol, John, thank you for inviting us. Lihia. I'm a performer, and principally at this moment, for the last 6 months and into the indefinite future, I'll be Lihia's performer in this piece called Sorrow Swag. I'm also, I co-direct a journal and a platform with Tanya Rubik called Native Strategies, which is a 10-issue journal looking at different practices in Los Angeles, and also a curatorial platform within which we make those artists visible through live shows. And lastly, I run a new space called PAM, which is in Highland Park, and it's a residency for performance artists wanting to make theater, and for theater artists who are interested in going beyond experimental theater into a more, we would say, performance art realm. Mm-hmm. So that kind of migration back and forth.
My name is Lihia Lewis. I'm a dancer and choreographer. I'm based in Berlin. I've been working in LA for the last few months, and I directed the last work, Sorrow Swag, which Brian Getnick was the star of. And my brother, George Lewis, aka Twin Shadow, composed a beautiful sound score for the work. So I'm working in performance. I realized a career as a dancer. I've toured extensively across Europe, performing with various choreographers. And as of recently, I started to direct work. And Sorrow Swag is the second work that I've directed. I've stepped outside of the role of of being the performer and actually started to direct other bodies and other subjectivities. And I was forever grateful that I had the opportunity to work with Brian, because it's sort of enabled a sort of rich and deep collaboration that's ongoing, and it's enabled a lot of my ideas to sort of come into a material realm. And so, yeah. And I'm happy to also be in LA and to sort of test the LA scene a bit with this material.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. And I was wondering if maybe you could start by telling us a little, Lihia, about the title Sorrow Swag, because it's like so evocative. And I mean, I guess I also know, you know, we've talked a little about the piece and it seems like there's like a really interesting background story. So could you say a little more about how you conceived of the piece, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So I started the research for the work a bit over a year ago, and I was interested in approaching theater, specifically looking at Samuel Beckett's Not I and Jean-Louis' Antigone. So I started by training in method acting. So I took a method acting workshop in Paris under the direction of Robert Castle. And it was while I was in this method acting workshop, we were working on sensory-based exercises, that I realized that I absolutely have to make a theater work. And I was sort of fearful of approaching language coming from dance. And that in that workshop, I sort of recognized all of the potential of transforming language and how powerful that could be. And to lend language into like a sort of poetic realm. And so I started to work independently. Then I came to LA to work at Peter Space. I'm also very grateful
for favorite.
Peter Space,
run by Jimmy. Kid.
Yeah, incredible space. And they gave me a residency to work, and that's where I met Brian. And when we started to work, I knew that I was going to inevitably transform Samuel Beckett's Not I. That was like the foundation of the work, and I was sort of reimagining it. The Not I piece, I don't know if you all are familiar with it, but it's this piece, stage work, performed originally by Billy Whitelaw at the Royal Court, with this mouth that's sort of floating in space, and it's delivering a monologue on suffering, and it's an incredible, incredible monologue. And my work inevitably deals with sadness, so I sort of was approaching this work and the language around this work to deal with these topics of suffering and empathy, which are inevitably topics that are sort of reoccurring in my work. And I started to work with Brian on also the on a monologue on happiness by Jean-Louis, and we started workshopping it. So I originally was going to be in the work, and then I was working with Brian, who came to my workshops, because I generally teach and then workshop ideas with other people to sort of test the material. And I was so impressed by Brian's embodiment and his commitment and his total like understanding of what I was after. And and he was willing to take the risk to go there with me. And we worked really pretty hardcore. And the work sort of developed outwards. It started as two monologues, and then that were framed around the silent scream, or this final scream, rather, not silent, but actually a very audible, like a very loud primal scream.
Guttural
scream. Exactly, full on, with these like floating grills that were in his mouth.
That was pretty amazing, seeing like these grills like in pitch darkness. Dark, you know,
grill mouth.
And in that work, a lot of things sort of emerged conceptually. Like I was interested in not only Samuel Beckett's Not I, so I transformed Samuel Beckett's Not I into just the actual scream, the full embodiment of this suffering, which realizes itself as this final wail, and also performing a monologue by Billy Whitelaw, who talks about the embodiment or what it was like to perform that intense, visceral monologue that was performed at the Royal Court.
It's from an interview.
It's from an interview. Yeah. So
where she's trying to explain this experience and also expressing the desire for her to have been simultaneously the performer and also a body witnessing her performance, because as Lihia described, it's just her mouth that's floating on that stage, and she describes the terror sort of it evokes in the audience. And so this interview is it's very poignant, because you see her imagining what the effect was Mm-hmm. She had only heard about the effect. She had heard about like the sort of mythology of her own performance, but never witnessed it. Mm-hmm. And there's something about performing and then losing the performance at the same time, which is very, it's very special to this arena of performance art.
Absolutely.
You're losing it the minute you generate it. You're giving it up. Mm-hmm. I really found a lot in that speech. Interested in. I have to say also that I met Lihia at a time when I don't think I consciously knew this, but I wanted to make a shift in my practice from creating a series of self-directed, self-authored pieces, working in costumes, which I primarily have done for the last 7 years. And I was really curious as to what it would be like to leave the costumes, leave the apparatus behind, and perform as my own body. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised, actually, that you found something in me, like in my body, that you wanted to work with. So that was, to me, it was like, I'm going to go to school, like in this, and learn about these different disciplines of acting and then also, and this maybe is a segue into another topic, which is I'm very curious about what performance culture is like in other cities other than Los Angeles. I've studied it for 7 years, which is mm-hmm. Through Native Strategies, primarily with Tanya. I have deep connections and relationships with primarily dancers who are artists who live in Berlin, but I had never experienced Berlin as a working artist before, and so Lihia provided this opportunity mm-hmm. to go there and also study the culture of performance that's in Berlin and see it in stark contrast to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. That's intriguing. Like, can you say a little bit more about that? Like, this is the things that you noticed that stuck out at you?
This is something we talk about all the time, in that we are basically taking this piece. I mean, you are taking this piece. It's German money that we're...
Yeah,
allowing me to go to Berlin, and we're performing it. We've performed it twice in Los Angeles, and now in January we'll be performing at the Sophienzelle.
Yep, Sophienzelle Theater. Yep.
Theater, and so again in Berlin. And maybe I'll just speak a little bit about Los Angeles in contrast, and maybe if you would want
sure.
to talk about Berlin. LA, you know, it's, as many people know, it is this international draw for performers who are interested in the freedom of experimentation and hybrid practice that LA offers. There is no condition here other than try it, experiment with it, do it. If it's like 2 weeks in the making, if you just thought of it last night, you can do it here. You will not be punished for making an experimental work that isn't the final thing. You can present an intense kind of rehearsal to your peers, to interesting people. It's the place to be in the world to make performance on the in a community of experimental workers. It is the place. And at the same time, we lack venues of a certain caliber or a certain, let's say, visibility in the international world for performance. We have an ecology of very excellent venues that are all working in tandem, but we have no equivalent to the German model and the Belgian model and perhaps the French model as well, of growing a piece in a round of performance venues that are all sort of interconnected so that the artist develops a kind of masterwork. There is no sort of impetus for us to make our masterworks yet in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's all very grassroots. Like,
yes.
It's just a ton of like grassroots venues and initiatives and projects and stuff. Yeah.
And it's also but what's interesting too, and I'll give it back to you to talk
no
about
problem.
Berlin and what your experience
yeah.
is that also in the on the grassroots roots level are your blog and your radio show together, and you are a worker from the Getty, and you are here in Los Angeles working like with and alongside and going to shows. This is like this interpenetration, this kind of critical framework that is also a kind of surveying mechanism of what is the connection. It's also a grassroots mechanism. Mm-hmm. It's something that you initiated because you saw a need for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's something you wanted to do. And Native Strategies is also this as well. It comes from this curious place.
Yeah.
So we have all these different grassroots efforts They're not necessarily overlapping and intersecting, but we have a lot of grassroots efforts to find out about that. And I feel like something is bubbling and percolating.
Yes.
The more we talk, the more we have conversations like this.
Yeah.
I think that that grassroots power is in this position right now to, from itself, like create that platform. I don't think it has to be administered from the top down. I think we might be able to do something, pull it together.
And go to the next level.
Go to the next level, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that right now, performers such as yourself, like, feel like they need to go elsewhere in order to develop to the next level? Like, is that something that happens? Because LA doesn't provide that sort of, you know, next platform.
In the way that, like, artists, you know, visual artists, for a long time had their studios here, but then they would have to have shows elsewhere, you know.
I think they still do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say that I had a history of going back and forth between Berlin and New York and LA for various reasons, mm-hmm. and would have wanted to pursue that anyway. I think... I'll just say yes. Yeah. I'm just going to say yes.
I mean,
yeah.
I think there's a little bit of a mythology of working, or not a mythology. I mean, I think people do work locally, and I do think all of these initiatives are really important. But I do think inevitably that we're, as artists working contemporarily, we're like interested in what's happening in other communities. And I think that's really important. And that's also what brought me from Europe here. Mm-hmm. I've been in Europe for the last 8 years, and I missed the American performance culture. I was curious about it. I was like, what's happening now, specifically in LA, where you don't get to see what's happening in LA abroad. In New York, where in Europe, it's the stronger connection. But in LA, seems to be very specific and very underground. Like, you really have to hunt to find out what's happening. But there are incredible voices, and there's incredible work being produced here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that now we just have to find as many opportunities to share what we're doing, because it's not so we lose the hyper specificity, let's say. Like, I'm interested in specificity, but how does that coalesce with other performance cultures, or how do you...
Do you mean regional specificity?
Regional specificity, or just to sort of, I mean, I'm intrigued by the way that Brian engages with performance here. And so for me, it's super interesting to have him come to Europe and meet my friends that understand a totally different model. They're all like quite privileged, I could say.
But could you describe that model? Like, what? In a nutshell.
I mean, European culture still, promotes culture and art, and they believe in supporting it financially. There's a national budget.
Yeah.
Like, cities believe in promoting art and supporting artists, and that artists can. They don't have to live a ghetto life. Like, they can actually participate in
full-time.
You know, exactly. Yeah. You can work full. Yeah. I work full time as an artist. I've.
For how long?
For 7 years.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the arts are considered like an essential part of life over
It's an integral part of the social fabric of European culture.
Sounds heavenly.
It sounds heavenly, but
there's a catch.
But
here it comes.
There's always a catch, of course. You do miss the sort of grassroots movements. Like, their grassroots doesn't operate in Europe. It doesn't have the same efficacy, partially because maybe it's not needed, but I disagree. There's always, the institution can't account for everything. There's inside of the institutional framework, there's always the inclusive and the ones that are included and the ones that are excluded. Huh. So it wasn't easy to fight my way in, you know what I mean? It wasn't easy at all. And I've been fortunate enough to sort of, live working as a dancer and getting a bit of support now as a young choreographer, but by no means is it easy, especially if you're from the outside. So, there's a lot of ideology wrapped around these institutions and what they deem appropriate. It's a thing of practices. What practices are appropriate for the institution, which aren't. Right. And when you have these grassroots movements, you're always operating on the level of difference. There's always, tends to be more complexity, let's say.
Okay. It sounds like, do you feel like it's more fertile here as far as the experimentation and the different kinds of things that can go on, the different different types of collaborations and juxtapositions?
I feel like there's just a different type of support. I just see that it's I don't know. It's like it's like friends coming together and like building something. It's based more on intimate relations, which produces something very different. I don't know what's better or worse. They're just different, and they're inevitably they're both interesting. Yeah. One has more efficacy on the level of like this, like social or political change. I think that when you work institutionally, you have opportunities to be more effective. Mm-hmm. But I do think this space that operates outside of the institution is super important because it does enable certain type of experimentation. Mm-hmm. It enables very like many voices. And there's less like hierarchical structures at play. So I think
we can say, I mean, I think we could, we could say that in LA, the artist is the framework. The artist makes the framework pretty much.
Yeah.
Is the primary kind of motivator.
Is the motivator, is the audience, is the venue maker, primarily.
Yeah.
And in Germany, it seems to be theater.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like, contemporary performance is supported through theaters.
Massive theaters like you wouldn't believe.
Massive theaters like you wouldn't believe.
Three Zeppelins.
And they support practices, theater practices. That's a whole other mode of operating. It's a whole different relationship to performance when you go and you can actually afford to have a practice. You can go to the studio and you can actually build a skill set to realize a work. Mm-hmm. I can go and train in method acting in order to shape a work because I'm a dancer interested in theater. Yeah. So there's opportunity that these kind of opportunities be in spaces of learning. Not to say that you can't do that without support, but it's another type of hustle, another type of grind.
Are a lot of different practices supported through the theater system in Germany? Like, for example, could someone like Dawn Casper, like, you know, receive support if she were to enter that system?
How would she enter it, though?
Yeah, how would she enter? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with her practice.
I guess it's more like performance art, like less performance theater art. And more performance art.
Dawn's
or
work
endurance
would look,
work.
Dawn's work would be magnificent in any one of those spaces, actually. I think Dawn would be absolutely up to the task of doing it, but would they recognize that potential?
The value of it?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think they work by affiliation. I think they accept
definitely. It's national funding. I mean, we can't romanticize it too much. They have a sort of national identity. They do support certain types of, you know, work that have a certain type of identity that they value, that they see is valuable for their culture. So it's not a given. I mean, there are reasons why I've worked extensively as a performer. I mean, this is one way of also institutionalizing yourself as well, and operating in theaters, becoming familiar
It would be great if it went the other way. I mean, it would be great if
would be dope.
I would love to see Rafa Esparza and Dawn Casper and Jimmy James Kidd and Nick Duran and Sam White. I would like to see all
residencies
those
for
people.
Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Eddie Vuitton, but I think this will happen. I mean, I think what's exciting about me and Brian's relationship is now there's this like LA Berlin connection, and like, I mean, I'm certainly interested in sharing with the people in Berlin, like what I've seen here, like, you know, what I've experienced and what's happening. And I always do. And I think there will be opportunities in the future for these kinds of exchanges. And I think it's like necessary, actually.
I was going to say, it sounds from what you're describing that it could be very fruitful to sort of go between the two worlds and sort of operate between the two worlds because of the very different benefits that you get from the two environments.
Absolutely. And also
exchange.
Yeah, most definitely. And also to test your work in different contexts, it's so important. It's you know, we take it for granted, actually, how much certain contexts shape the meaning of our work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a very successful showing at Human Resources. I'm excited to see what will happen in Berlin and how the work is perceived. I mean, there's a lot of, like, cultural tropes that I'm using that might not be as identifiable to a European audience. And I call it, like, racial drag. I mean, he's wearing gold grills, doing white boy swag. There's a reference to Chris Brown.
I was much more nervous in Los Angeles.
Of course.
Given the material. Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, so there's racial drag, but there's also gender drag, too,
definitely,
right? Because originally you thought of this as a piece that maybe you would perform. So what was that transition like, where it was, like, going from you as the performer to Brian as the performer? What was that negotiation?
this sort of transference of embodiment. We worked very closely in the studio. I do this sort of authentic movement practice, but my own version of some of the methods of Stanislavski. And so we would play a lot with language, and we were like next to each other all the time in the studio with, you know, playing, riffing, finding the potential of the monologues and the language, and sort of trying to like dig into the subtext of the monologues. And I think inevitably, like what we do is we would work so close to one another, but we'd also use each other as material to build the piece. So everything that was generated in the space was free go, you know, was like material for the piece. So there are moments where, you know, there are things that Brian does that are very, you know, people that know me and they see him, they're like, oh my God, he's like, that's so Lihia, or you know what I mean? Or that's so great. You know, I just think the sheer fact of being in close proximity while developing this work produced something. And there is, I mean, definitely, I mean, he performs an Antigone monologue as well. So there's that
the,
as well.
Billy Whitelaw. All the speeches from
it's
women.
Actually all the women, exactly. Yeah. It's all, it's all speeches from, I mean, actually all of the emblems are women. It's Billy Whitelaw, it's Antigone, and even Martha Graham was a reference at one point.
Yeah.
She's still there.
Mm-hmm. She's still present.
She's still there and strict as ever. I always putting my hand out to her at a certain point, and I was like, sometimes she would slap it away, and sometimes she'd not slap it. She never would accept it.
No, but they're all sort of
invisibly.
Yeah, invisibly present.
They're fictional. Martha wasn't there.
Yeah, so we're working sort of with I guess I could say, yeah, like a sort of queer embodiment. So it's always an othering. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in abject as well as I'm interested in noble. I mean, we're always trying to complicate embodiment and make it as slippery as possible. And that's something Brian's very skilled at as a performer.
Lihia, have you met E.J. Hill?
I have yet to meet him. I haven't met him formally yet. I've heard that I should meet him.
But. You really should. He's another amazing performance artist working here.
Yeah,
he's
great.
He's really great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. EJ?
You're out there. EJ.
I'll be in Chinatown.
We're in Chinatown. Come on down.
So.
Well, you know, I actually had, you know, kind of one, you guys were talking about kind of the, you know, developing this piece together and working in this kind of very intimate setting. And I was just wondering kind of logistically how did the support for this piece materialize? I mean, did you have to kind of workshop it to a certain point and then be in touch with, you know, the theater in Berlin, you know, about...
It's all Lihia.
Yeah,
like, was that complicated because you were doing it here? Was it something that they were receptive to? Or?
They're totally receptive to it. I think I'm very fortunate. I work closely with Anna Mulder, who's a curator now at the theater, and she's curated two things before, and I think she was excited that I was taking my practice to LA, and also being American, also sort of being nostalgic for American culture again, and I felt like also I would inevitably find a community that I could talk to about the things that I'm interested in, and I couldn't have the same conversations in Europe. So I think, she's actually like very supportive of it, and I work still extensively in Europe, so I think it's okay, like it's totally fine. I mean, I applied for funding, and that's what enabled the early portion of the research, and I continue to apply for funding that enables me to continue to work, to come out, and hopefully eventually pay Brian a good salary. Still working on it, but
yeah. Well, that was something that you did, you know, when we were talking about this a few days ago. You know, you said that one of the reasons for working with the kind of larger institutional or different institutional structure is precisely because it offers, you know, kind of financial support for the artists too, and not just kind of like cultural support. So HR is great
because absolutely.
It can bring people and kind of you can get a sense of what people are thinking. But, you know, unfortunately, HR isn't at the point yet where they can offer that kind of, you know, like a living wage per, you know, so to speak. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or a plane ticket.
Yeah. Or a plane ticket, even for that matter. Yeah. I'm still very fortunate that in Berlin that I'm able to still get support. That's the only way, to be honest, that this would have actually been able to happen. And so they're really, I am fortunate, and I recognize that. And you know, I had a wonderful conversation with Deborah Hay, who's a former postmodern choreographer, still working extensively. She's in residency at UCLA, and she's like, stay in Europe. I'm romanticizing LA. She's like, no, just stay in Europe. And it's,
I do feel like this, this sort of topic of the LA scene and its relationship to international scenes all over seems to be something that's kind of in the air right now that I've noticed. Like, I mean, I just read about, you know, the Made in LA curators for 2016. Did you see that article in LA Times? And they're very consciously going to think about, you know, LA's relationship to the international scene, and can there be an LA scene given that it's just so perforated with international influences, and what exactly is an LA artist when people come here from all over? So
when galleries are setting up
shop. What do you
shop?
Think about that? Yeah. Wait, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm curious,
Yeah.
About which part?
Oh, like the Made in LA sort of being a survey of LA, and then it becomes also open to artists who are here for like maybe several months and then they leave.
I feel like since the beginning, there's been a lot of anxiety about possibly being a little too inward gazing or a little too provincial. Like, I think a lot of people felt like, oh God, why are we doing a survey of ourselves?
Right.
And I think there's also, there's this element of like, yeah, LA is really a very, in a lot of ways, a very transitory city.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's hard to sort of pin down like what exactly is an LA artist. You know, I mean, the painter who won the first Made in LA award left for New York.
Yeah,
he lives in New York now, and and you could argue he was only here for grad school.
Well, but Maleko also moved to New York because he got a job there. I mean, you know, if he had gotten a job here, I think they would have liked to stay here. You know,
yeah,
so
sure.
That's partly.
But that does open up the question of, you know, there is no such thing as an LA artist or a genuine LA artist or whatever. You know.
Yeah, you would say the same about Berlin as well.
Or
I mean,
New York. But the thing is, there is a but because actually this was something that got brought up at the human resources event that Jennifer Doyle and Raquel Gutierrez put together, Decolonizing the White Cube, the first one, which is that we have many, many communities that are existing unknown to each other, as you know, in LA, but they're more known to artists that are working than they are to curators and persons at museums at this moment. I would say that these groups are actually sort of better known amongst practitioners, and the mandate, or like the, let's say, the structure to make a show that surveys our city, Los Angeles, could actually be far more interesting if it was decided that they would look harder at our landscape.
Deeper.
And look deeper in our landscape. And perhaps consider the possibility that these small communities are not provincial, making provincial or small work, but they're making a specific work which is able to be made in Los Angeles. And because it's able to be made in Los Angeles, that is specifically a Los Angeles phenomenon.
That's a great point.
And these are also, I would also say, I'm gonna give a shout out to Patrice Marie Couleurs Brignac, who is at St. Elmo's Village. This is a small community of primarily persons of color artists.
Yeah.
And there's also Promsedon Ock down in Long Beach, who's created this incredible space, which I'm blanking on the name. Do you guys remember the name at the moment? But it's basically, it's an intersection of traditional Cambodian and new media practices. And anyway, these are just a few. This is not, to make a small community for a specific kind of practice is not a retreat. Especially not in Los Angeles from aesthetics, nor politics. And we need to, I mean, please bring me a Made in LA show that actually does the job of looking at what's made in LA. Look harder.
Wow. That is such a great point. That really, really is.
You listening, RM and Hamza?
Yeah, right? Let Brian Getnick school everybody.
I don't mean to school anybody. I mean, I'm saying that's an invitation because you could meet anybody, you can all meet here. We're so lucky that people who work at institutions hang with us and we hang with them. That is cool. That is also something that's specific in LA. We get to do this. This hierarchy is quite a bit softer than it is in other cities.
We do get to do that. But you know, the Made in LA thing, I mean, maybe it's kind of like a biennial trap sort of a deal because, I mean, I think that all three iterations, the future one included, they've all been flawed in that they kind of err on the side of, like, what's cool in the art world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like doing what you say and, like, really digging deep into LA art practices. And not being afraid to do that or not feeling like it might be too provincial and taking a very honest look.
Absolutely.
I do think that all three iterations have been, I mean, even this thing about the international thing, it just seems like a kind of a trendy art world dialogue to be having.
Well, they've already, I mean, look, we had Pacific Standard Time back in, what was it, 2011? Was it, that was?
11, 12, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, it was a survey of art made in Los Angeles from 1945 to 80,
yeah.
Right, so in that show, we see all of the major institutions bringing the young work of the people who are now occupying a lot of real estate in our canon. You would then think, or extend from that, that if a young Paul McCarthy and a young Eleanor Anton, a young Mike Kelly, and a young Kim Jones were all operating and making this kind of experimental and fringe and Los Angeles work at that time, and it became canonized, they'd already realized that this is a place that is fodder for that canon. You don't have to give up the canon. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to think, oh, it's either community first or it's the agreed upon international, the international community will follow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We've already had this precedent. Look in any history book, any art history book, it is filled to the brim with Los Angelinos.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make sense that we just accept that this is where we generate, you know, internationally like regarded aesthetic work.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just put that whole conversation aside and look harder and bring some resources to supporting and inculcating and just promoting the hell out of what we already have here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not provincial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's being socially responsible.
Yeah. It's being aesthetically responsible. It's being engaged in it's contemporary,
yeah,
please.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Get into it.
Should we take a music break or do you have another question?
Well, actually, I think that maybe we can transition from that and talk, speaking about the kind of the specific, you know, like, because we've been talking about, you know, the work that you two have been working across two continents, you know, and producing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little about, Brian, you know, your own kind of, you mentioned earlier that you're involved with Native Strategy and with PAM. Can you say a little more about, you know, how those came about, you know, as something that you wanted to do specifically, you know, because it's not always the case that artists want to kind of, you know, do work that is about engaging other artists' work, you know what I'm saying? It's counterintuitive.
Platforms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were already precedents for doing this in the artists community. You know, I started Native Strategies in 2011, and shortly after beginning it, met Tanya Rubik, who is an artist and a graphic designer, and quickly formed an alliance with her. Thinking about how the journal could become like both an archiving mechanism, but then also an impetus or a kind of igniting mechanism to create performance to happen in real time and space in the landscape. And so it never felt like I was leaving visual arts practice behind. The main reason that Tanya is an artist and like every single thing that she makes is a singular autonomous speaking work of art. And the document is not doesn't necessarily have to be a kind of dead thing. Mm-hmm. The process of creating that document is just temporally different than a performer walking into a room, communicating to an audience, and exiting. The document is that voice being communicated, and over a longer time, reaching the ears and eyes of a reader in the mm-hmm. future. So it seemed like a very natural sort of collaboration mm-hmm. to begin with, working with her. And I was just so curious also. Like, it became an excuse to meet people. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to meet and talk to, and I'm still going to, and Tanya is also, we're just meeting so many interesting people and learning about our city. We're making 10 issues by 2016.
Yeah, and this past summer was like a mini festival where, you know, you had a residency at LACE and you were producing it.
Right.
Kind of with, it was a very interesting way of, you know, producing a journal in some way. Yeah.
Well, that residency at LACE, and thank you so much, you know, to LACE and to also to Robert Crouch and Geneva Skeen, who were there before the current administration. But for actually getting the funding to make this possible. But we basically, Tanya designed a three-dimensional Native Strategies issue, mm-hmm. Within which we had three stages of the development of the document, which was we had an area for performance where musicians would meet and actually do performances and interviews for each other. We had a section that was live archiving all of that material and video material as well. And then we had a third section, which was distribution. my boyfriend's outside. Pictures. So cute. Distributing as we speak. So the entire room became a kind of three-dimensional process of what Native Strategies is, which mm-hmm. is like both, it's the presentation of live performance, it's the documenting of that, and then it's the distribution of that. We worked with Jules Gimbrone, who is a sound artist and a curator, to come up with, I think we had over 20 different sound artists and musicians working together in that space. And that's a model we'd like to repeat because it takes all of the energy of the performance and it throws it immediately into the creation of the journal and the distribution of that material into the world. Mm-hmm.
So are you still continuing? Because I know you had a plan this was like a 5-year plan where you were going to release 2 issues every year. Are you still sticking with that plan and then it's basically going to end at that point? Or where are you at with that right now?
I started this with Molly Sullivan and Zemula Barr, and we, mm-hmm. at that time we thought it was going to be a biannual journal, but we realized as soon as I started working with Tanya that is not possible mm-hmm. for us to actually do, because each time we create a journal we have to also create a different revenue stream to make that happen. Yeah. So
it's
just
a lot of work.
It's too much work to make, and also it doesn't make sense for us to be limited to a production schedule that way, because when we have somebody in our midst we want to talk to, we can just now talk to them and gather all of the content simultaneously for several issues ahead. Mm-hmm. And then when we have the resources, then go for it. Mm-hmm. But we are committing to making 10 issues by mm-hmm. 2016, after which we will make a book.
Interesting.
And at that point we are going to be working with at that point we're going to be starting to talk very seriously with people who are also on the outskirts of the performance art community, who are monitoring it, who are thinking about it, Carol, mm-hmm. John, who to bring some theory to it, what is this material? It's the raw material, these 10 issues. It's first person interviews with the artists, it's mm-hmm. data. Mm-hmm. So we're going to theorize after we have the data gathered.
Native Strategies is so great. I mean, it really fills a need that basically hasn't been met since the demise of high performance, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Definitely been a big gap. Mm-hmm. So thank you for doing it.
Oh, cool. Thank you for supporting it.
I'm curious how you find the artists that you interview. I'm curious about your curatorial practice
deep
also.
Deep research,
Let's
school the curators.
Yeah, school everybody.
Oh, man, I am not meaning to school anybody. I mean, they've got their own, you know.
Don't worry, they're taking notes.
I mean, first of all, you know, I fell in love with Los Angeles due to its being a hybrid city, being social, just basically falling in love with its citizens. Mm-hmm. And that is a mixed crowd. And so there's a mandate that I have on myself, and Tanya is on board with this, is that we are going to try to, as best as possible, represent diversity, the diverse population. And this includes all communities of color, gender identities. We are also conscious of age, mm-hmm. of and also degrees of education. That's very, very important, especially if you want to understand the Los Angeles context. Is mm-hmm. so many of these of our artists are, you know, have not gotten a degree, mm-hmm. A formal education, and yet are making work that is absolutely intuitively in line mm-hmm. with the quote-unquote zeitgeist, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. And then it's just kind of a matter of asking around. There's so many, I mean, people are my resource for finding other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One conversation flows into, oh, did you hear of, did you hear of, did you hear of? Mm-hmm. And then generally the answer is no. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, really? You know, there were 10 like Afrofuturist collectives like in, you know, in Compton at this time, and where are they now? You know, like mm-hmm. this kind of like, it's just that. It's just, it kind of flows like a like dominoes.
It is really organic here.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. I gotta say that, like, well, your other project, Pam, I've learned a lot about artists that I didn't know about that I thought were incredibly intriguing when I saw them at Pam. Like Dorothy Hoover, we had her on the show.
Oh, how great. Yeah.
Yeah, and she actually did a radio play just for K-Chan.
Oh, that's just fantastic.
For Performance so Now, even.
Yeah, it was really good.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, there's also let me go back a little bit towards like the institutions that are also like creating venues within which I go to and see like a lot of artists I had never seen before, and Cal Arts and UCLA and I don't know why it's always like it's the easiest one, the University of.
USC.
Yeah. I was like, UCLA. But I mean, making studio visits, you know, the schools that we have here, the schools, the institutions, and this side of this sort of this pleasure sort of principle of the what's happening in nightclubs here and has always mm-hmm. been happening, and the activists, you know, it's
so vast.
It's vast. It's vast. Yeah.
It's a really broad map.
But it's a pleasure to explore it. It's a pleasure, you know.
Do you want to talk some more about what inspired you to start Pam?
It's like I met Lihia around the same moment I was committing to making Pam the primary sculptural output from my practice. I was making costumes for 7 years, and last week I put them all into boxes. Mm. I have like 7 years and 6 boxes right now. It was kind of a bittersweet moment. Where I decided that actually through a lot of input from the community that Pam would be a much more powerful space if it was fully committed to being a performance space, 100% of the space.
And it was interesting, you know, it was Friday night, right? Like Friday night when you kind of were announcing that, you know, you were going to give the entire, because Pam occupied, I guess, a space that it shared with your studio, and now you're kind of devoting the entire space to Pam, and your studio is going to be a mobile space now, or?
No, my studio, I'm just sort of eliminating the notion of a studio.
We're going to be post-studio.
I guess so. I need to build things with my hands to be a normal, healthy person. Mm-hmm. to put that energy in, to be a good boyfriend. I started Pam because I wanted to create, I mean, I felt like Native Strategies, it was a research tool. It was the data gathering tool. It wasn't a place to make theory, really. Mm-hmm. Pam fills the need, not even fills, but just begins a model of fulfilling the need to give time mm-hmm. to artists to find out what is the fullness of their practice. Mm-hmm. And I am starting something. It's not enough. 3 weeks is a small amount of time, but we don't currently have any institutional version of this, of Monta Vista Projects actually might be another one. I know Jimmy James Kidd at Peter has done residencies in the past and maybe doing them again. But
a performance incubator.
But specifically a performance incubator. I mean, I wanted to learn deeper in a more detailed way about artists' practices by working alongside them. And I wanted there to be a precedent to discover, you know, like, what does time do for my work? you know, because within performance art as a, if it were a form, it, I don't, we can talk about this later, but I don't believe it to be a form, I believe it to be an arena. There isn't there is this kind of a notion that you step in, you do it, and it's real. As Marina Abramović says, the knife is the knife, the blood is the blood. You know, but the thing is, the real like can be also can be worked on and workshopped. And also, if you step into a venue often enough with no rehearsal, but you've done it like over 10 years of not quote unquote rehearsing, you've been rehearsing for 10 years, stepping into a space and doing something. Mm-hmm. That is a kind of rehearsing. That is a kind of rigor, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to bring something into our community where it's, mm-hmm. you know, specifically for this purpose for yeah. developing.
Well, that's a very generous kind of offer to the community, for, mm-hmm. you know, for you and Lihia. Are you working with Pam now, right?
Yeah, I just started rehearsing. yesterday was my first rehearsal. Brian was watching my first rehearsal without him. I'm working on a new piece. The working title is Minor Meanings. Mm-hmm. I will have a work in progress showing on the 8th at downstairs at mm-hmm. Human Resources, and hopefully I'll probably show something in the meanwhile between now and then and at PAM. But mm-hmm. I did just start working there, and it's incredible. It's like this little incubator. It's like safe. Yeah. You feel it. Like you feel Brian's love all around you. Like it's mm-hmm. incredible. It's like absolutely facilitates a space to research, mm-hmm. and so I'm also grateful for that. it's also very exciting. I think that also just to continue on the conversation about like time-based art, that's another thing, like this sort of commitment to giving artists time, and mm-hmm. and that enables a certain rigor, it enables a certain development in time, it enables like practice to become real, to be made real, and mm-hmm. that's I just am sort of underlining how poignant that is and how relevant it is for mm-hmm. for artists now.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm kind of really struck by is that, you know, one of the reasons that you hear, or I hear that, you know, people flocked to Berlin was because there was so much space, and it was kind of, you know, you kind of, artists had all the space they needed, and, you know, it was kind of this real luxury. But it sounds like you're finding that more here in some ways, like that kind of space to think and kind of develop. And
most definitely, because everything that you do in Berlin inevitably has to go through a long application process, mm-hmm. and you're in the process of developing a work, but it won't be realized it won't actually have its premiere until a year after mm-hmm. you've started to conceive it. So I like this model here, that it's, you can sort of be immediate with your interests and with your desires.
Like you start yesterday in 3 weeks, yeah, in January.
Exactly,
yeah.
And it's a testing ground for material. And I really think that the process of performance making, it's not a performance until you have your audience, of course. So I think that it's important to integrate showings inside mm-hmm. inside the process of a larger work, and that's what we did with Sorrow Swag. I think the performance at Human Resources was so successful because we had done like 4 other showings. Mm-hmm. We started working together in March, so mm-hmm. I think it's over time that this work can sort of have a mm-hmm. potency, or you know,
and without the pressure of like the official debut or anything like that, you're kind of just testing.
Absolutely, testing with audiences, getting feedback, and then I feel like now we're really ready for the theater because mm-hmm. we went through this intense process of presenting in different formats, mm-hmm. From intimate formats to larger ones. At Human Resources was quite a big showing.
Yeah. So will you be showing, will you be doing Sorrow Swag again in LA so that people like me can find
We would love to do it. we're working on that now.
We would enjoy that.
We would enjoy it also because my twin brother is based here. So we had the good fortune of having him play live as well, live accompaniment for this piece. And that won't always be the case. Like when we go to Berlin, I mean, my brother's a touring musician, and so he's not going to be able to join us in Berlin, but hopefully in LA.
So we were really privileged to have had all three of you kind of there, kind of doing.
Most definitely.
Okay. And then the new piece that you're developing at PAM, is that something that we should kind of keep an eye out? So there's going to be a version of it at Human Resources, but will there also be a presentation at PAM for people who are interested, or?
Most definitely. I mean, I tend to work in a super chilled out way. Like, I like to call it like open studio. So I actually have rehearsals. I'm workshopping ideas. I mm-hmm. love for people to come in to play along with me. Mm-hmm. And I sort of share my ideas. So I'll be at PAM. I mean, I don't have yet a fixed schedule, but I will be there for the next couple of weeks working also downstairs as well. And people are more than welcome to come have a look or have a conversation with me. I mean, it's very generative for my process. So.
Well, if you have showings, let us know.
I will.
Unfortunately, I'm out of town until the 7th, but maybe I can make the one on the 8th.
Well, at least I'll be here on the 8th, yeah.
Will we be after the 7th? Back here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so hopefully I can make that one.
Yeah, I hope so. Otherwise, you'll see Sarah Swag again. Yeah.
Somewhere if she performs.
Somewhere.
It'll be back.
Soon. Yeah, it'll be come back. We'll bring it back.
Well, it's been a really exciting hour to have both of you on.
Yeah,
such
really
an intense
good.
And wonderful and rewarding conversation. Thank you both
thank
so
you.
Much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, this was Carol thanks and John. Thank you so much. Yeah. And thank you for everything that you do for the community. I mean, I'm sure people thank you all the time, but I just want to say that I'm really, so I feel so lucky to be amongst colleagues as strong as you. And
the feeling's mutual.
It makes it, you know, no one works in a bubble here. So,
no. Yeah. Well, we're
thank
looking.
You, Jennifer.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Moon is in the room.
Yeah.
In the room. It's just a love fest here.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to both of you, both on Sorrow Swag in Berlin and also Minor Meaning, is it?
Minor Meanings.
Minor Meanings coming up in a few weeks here in LA. And that's Performance Now for 2014. And. Join us again in January for our next edition.
Yeah, see y'all in 2015.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Bye.